afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, January 21st, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger, and I will be your host today. Well, I hope many of you had a chance to watch the State of the Union address delivered by Lyndon LaRouche on Wednesday. If you didn't see it yet, it's available. It was archived. He made some very detailed and very coherent points about the present crisis, and we're going to be elaborating some of those today. Now, I think one of the most important points he's made is that regardless of what's happening, and there have been some good signs, the sections in the U.S. military and intelligence establishment have come out very strongly against a war against Iran, have indicated to the Israelis that the Israelis should not do it. There are forces in Israel that have been moving, and just this week it was announced that a joint Israeli-U.S. military maneuver, one of the biggest, I think, ever, has been postponed 6 months. It may not even happen 6 months from now. The U.S. has also pulled some of our naval assets back a bit in the Strait of Hormuz. There's all kinds of discussion about the 5+1 talks with Iran taking place possibly in Turkey. So there are a number of interesting developments. But what LaRouche has said when he was asked about, does this mean there's not going to be a war? He says, not at all. Because the question of war has never been that there are objective causes for war. The two world wars in the last century occurred precisely because of British geopolitics and not because of so-called objective circumstances or nationalism or something of that sort, or even of greed, the usual argument that's given. And what LaRouche has been insisting is that we're going to stick to the real subject, which is that the only reason that war could happen would be that's the intention of the British Empire. And there are two aspects of their intention. One is just plain and simple population reduction. And the second is to stop the development in the Pacific region, where countries such as China and Russia primarily, but others including Japan, Korea, India, have indicated that they're not going to go down with the transatlantic system, that they're holding out for an alternative. And in fact, from the Russians and the Chinese, there's every indication that they would like to be sharing that with the United States. So today we're going to take a look at the Trans-Pacific region. We've had a lot of talk on this program and in the EIR and what has happened in the breakdown of the transatlantic. Tonight we'll take a different focus, and joining me will be two people who are familiar to those of you who read the EIR, Michael Billington, who writes extensively on Asia, and Tanu Maitra, who has also written quite extensively on Asia and in particular on areas of development. So, Mike and Tanu, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Let's begin with what we were discussing before the program, Mike, because I thought it was interesting the way you brought this up. But the idea of the possibility of war and extending the hot spots beyond what LaRouche calls the New Balkans, the Middle East, the most obvious is the situation on the Korean Peninsula. Although it does appear as though there may be some potential for change there, what's going on right now in North and South Korea?
Well, our younger members may not, and younger supporters may not be remember as clearly as the older folk, that for 20 or 30 years after World War II, one of the hottest spots in the world for potential warfare and the threat of war was Korea, which was divided the same as Germany was after World War II. I'm sure if Roosevelt had lived, that division itself would never have taken place. But the recent developments have been quite dramatic, and I think they exemplify what LaRouche talks about when he says a great Pacific alliance, primarily the U.S., Russia, and China, with this, as you mentioned, with Japan and Korea and others, India playing a key role in that, has the potential of completely breaking the back of the now completely bankrupt British-centered London Wall Street financial empire, which is in a state of absolute collapse, and replacing that with a global system of the sort LaRouche talks about, focused on real development, with the kind of Glass-Steagall and related financial measures needed, but underpinning that, the idea of great projects. So what happened in Korea is that after a very, very tense period leading into 2010, the North Korean government was approached by Russia, which has somewhat played a back seat in the last years of the so-called six-party talks that we're discussing, trying to denuclearize the
Russia
Korean.
Russia is one of those six parties, isn't it?
They're one of the six parties, but they played a backseat role all along. This was started by the Bush administration in 2003, I think. And the Russians have their own internal problems they were dealing with, but also they sort of let China handle that issue. China, of course, being the closest friend of North Korea, but also now increasingly close to South Korea. So, but it was going sour. And in 2010, about the same time that it was announced by Medvedev that Putin would be the candidate for president, sort of breaking all of the mythology about how Medvedev and Putin were enemies and were battling for power, and showed that they actually had a combined hand, one of their interventions was to go into North Korea and South Korea with the proposal that old plans that had been discussed for building a pipeline through North Korea, connecting South Korea with Russia, as well as with China. And then in the longer term, coupling that with railroad development, which would complete what LaRouche has always called the Great New Silk Road, or the Eurasian right. Land Bridge, as the Chinese call it, from Busan, the city at the very tip of Korea, all the way to Amsterdam. So with this idea, the Russians intervened and said to the North, now is the time to work with us backing this up, to reconcile with South Korea on the idea of development. And this, of course, goes back to Pope John Paul VI's idea of peace through development, that the new name for peace is development, something that...
LaRouche... Mike, this was occurring when Kim Jong-il was still alive.
Kim Jong-il was still alive. It was the same Mr. Strongman who'd been in power for a long time, but he took a shift. And our friends in South Korea indicated that it wasn't just him, it wasn't just this faction or that faction, but it's institutional. So then what happened, as you were referencing, he died. And when his one of his sons, Kim Jong-un, was sort of anointed to be the new leader in North Korea, the neoconservative crowd leaped at the opportunity to say, this is the chance for regime change. We can do what we did, you know, the kind of thing in Libya that we're planning in Syria and Iran. We can do it now because this new leader is a danger to the world. They had conferences in Washington saying now is the time, regime change, or else this horrible regime is going to build nuclear power plants and destroy the world and so forth and so on. When, in fact, our sources in South Korea said that's nonsense, that this shift toward the idea of collaborating with Russia, with China, with South Korea, and with support from the U.S. State Department, not from the White House, but from the Clinton circles, who have been meeting very closely with the Russians, with the Chinese, and with the South Koreans, and encouraging them to move towards this collaboration through development. So it worked. It's working.
Mike, let me ask you on that. We do know the story in North Korea the last couple of years, the problems with food, the poverty there. Is this playing a role when you say there are institutional moves within North Korea to be open to this? Is this driven by a sense of desperation, or is there actually a faction that sees a potential to get not just out of desperation, but into you might say, a new universe?
I think it's the latter. I think there is great concern about a recurring food crisis. It was horrendous in the 1990s. But they've generally got things under control. There have been some reforms in the North that people who are not prejudiced about this thing and not out to, you know, for regime change have reported honestly, including top American experts on this, who report that the developments in the North have been significant, not dramatic, but significant, in the kind of direction that China transformed itself through a certain level of opening up. But they were ready for that, and it was not just...
Are the Chinese playing a positive role with development in North Korea?
Absolutely. I won't go into the details here, but at the very northeast part of Korea, there's a port there, now called Rajin, which is close to Vladivostok and which is not that far from Russia, from China, rather. And both Russia and China have already begun the process of building railroads, for instance, which Russia has done from Vladivostok down to Rajin. And in the Chinese case, building a high-speed, not high-speed, a modern road from China into Rajin, which allows them to move the material from their northeast Heilongjiang area down towards down to the sea without having to go all the way down through down around Beijing. So in both cases, there's collaboration between Russia and China, and there's collaboration with the Koreans. And again, there's been general sort of quiet support from the United States State Department on the idea that having them all work together here is the best approach. So it's a very clear case of this idea of the Great Pacific Alliance, what could be achieved. Because if you break this North Korea hotspot, this constant point of tension, where you keep the United States in an adversarial position with China, with Russia, over this Korea Peninsula issue, if you break that, then there's nothing holding back the idea that these great powers can collaborate on building the entire Russian Far East, the Bering Strait Tunnel, the development of Siberia. It would be a basis on which the North and South Koreans could collaborate using the skilled labor in the North. And it's the fact that after World War II, when the division took place, it was the North that was the industrial part of the country. The South was the poor agricultural area. And, of course, there's been a miracle development in the South, which is a fascinating subject in itself, how they became a modern power.
I have an additional question on this, and we will be coming to Tanu to look at the situation in South Asia in just a moment. But this actually gets what you're describing is exactly what Mr. LaRouche has been discussing. Now, at the same time, we still see emissaries from Europe going. I believe Geithner just went. If I'm not mistaken, I think the French have been playing a role to try to get China and Japan to sign on to an anti-Iran embargo operation. At the same time, they're still hoping that the Chinese in particular will pour money in to bail out the euro. And we've been reporting that the Chinese and the Japanese say, we hope you get your house in order, but we've got other priorities. Is that generally the case? And what happened with Geithner's trip?
Yeah, they're not going to do it. Geithner's trip was partially that. But it also, you have to remember that since Obama took his tour of Asia in November, which completely broke the years of State Department careful diplomacy, to try to build up certain cooperation with Russia and China, in not just around Korea, but Myanmar and other parts of Asia. And Obama's trip was entirely, we must join together in a coalition of the willing, knowing full well that there's no prayer that they could get a kind of NATO operation surrounding China. The rest of the Asian countries don't, almost entirely, with very few exceptions, don't want to have anything to do with having to choose sides in Cold War style between the United States and China. But they are saying we want a coalition of the willing against China on economic policies. They have a free trade agreement they're trying to do, which excludes China and tries to build an alliance. And more importantly, they're deploying military forces, and they've announced a new military strategy, which is pivoting towards Asia, building up the Asia ring around China, with expanded military bases in the Philippines and Singapore, and, of course, the big one in Australia that Obama announced on his trip to Asia.
And if you listen to the Republican presidential debate, they're basically saying we have to be prepared to go to trade war, if not war against China. But we also had this very odd incident the other day. The former governor of Washington, who's the ambassador to China, Gary Locke, made some very unfortunate statements.
We wonder if he's competing with Mr. McFaul, who is the new Russian ambassador.
Your sense then from looking at this thing, and we'll get back to more specifics on the development perspective in a few moments, but in terms of the war danger, the other question I have is, are the Chinese as aware as the Russians are that the British threats against Syria and Iran are also targeting them?
They haven't been as vocal about that side. They've been very vocal that they oppose what's going on in Syria and Iran. But what they have responded with that sense of urgency to is the new U.S. strategic policy, the shift to Asia, which they clearly recognize with statements coming from their foreign ministry, their defense ministry, and some of their top PLA professionals who say, who could possibly believe that this is not targeting China, just as Putin and Medvedev had said, how can you not believe that these deployments in Iran and the deployment of the missile defense around Russia's border are not targeting Russia? They know it, and they're saying we're going to have to respond by building up our military capacity against a superior force in the United States. And the idea that the United States has to have an expanded military naval presence to guarantee the freedom of navigation, which is the line used by the British neocon crowd, is implying that China somehow is disrupting trade by disrupting freedom of the seas, is just absurd. There's no such thing. There is no such disruption of freedom of navigation. It's a line used to try to justify this ring around China, including a military presence. So they're very aware that they won't have anywhere to go without running into U.S. military forces, and if something is attempted to spring it off, like Korea, although you know it looks like it's going to be a tough one to try to pull that off, given the positive offensive going on for development there. But in that kind of a circumstance, or something in the South China Sea, this thing could explode very, very quickly.
You're listening to the LaRouche Show. It's January 21st, 2012. That was Michael Billington, who covers Asia for the Executive Intelligence Review, and we'll be back with Michael in a minute. We also have with us Tanu Maitra, who is very much involved, not just covering, but as an activist in dealing with governments in the southern part of Asia, the Indian subcontinent in particular. And Tanu, as we started with Mike, just reviewing the dangers of war and the fact that we're not really facing a strategic threat from China, we obviously do have a slightly different situation in South Asia, largely because of the very aggressive role of the British. So what does that look like right now in terms of this World War III danger Mr. LaRouche has been discussing?
Well, my observation is that this reduction in war threat vis-a-vis a war between the Western allies of the United States and Iran, I personally do not think that the war threat has been reduced at all, because what has happened is basically is that Iran has been continuously choked in the sense that now they have put those crippling sanctions on Iran. Iran's, you cannot, nobody can deal with the Central Bank of Iran. Anyone who deals with Central Bank of Iran will undergo sanctions. All these, if you add up, will add up to about one-third of oil revenues of Iran getting, you know, curbed or getting reduced, which means that Iran will run into very, very serious, already they're in serious economic
situation. But in a sense, this is already a war against
it. It is already a war. It's like, you know, there is a general in academia and people who apologize for one another usually use this word inadvertent war. There is no such thing as inadvertent war. You design things in such a way that a war happens. Inadvertent in the sense that when you choke a person, choke a person's throat, that person hits back. That is not an aggression. That is a defensive only thing left for him or her to do at that point in time. And Iran will have to do that. And that is when then say that it is an inadvertently started war.
Well, so, and we're also seeing acts of terrorism conducted against Iran in terms of the assassination of scientists, explosions at research and nuclear centers. So there already is, in that sense, an act of war being conducted.
No question about it that the war has started a long time back, that the troops are not marching or the bombs are not dropping. That doesn't mean that the war has not started. You do not put sanctions on a country if you are not at war with them. That is, you only, after you go to war, you put economic sanctions. But in this case, you know, the war, there is no difference between war and economic sanctions. So basically, the war has been launched against Iran. The violent part of it, which will involve the region and beyond, has not started as yet, but that would happen as well. There's no question about it. And there are all the plannings on ground. The U.S. has landed about 15,000 troops now in Kuwait. And if you take a good look at Iran's map, you will see the number of bases that surround Iran as unbelievable. There's over 30, 40 U.S. bases that exist all around. If we're going three or four in Afghanistan, on the southern Afghanistan bordering Iran, you include those and all that. But this is the old British design. And to discuss these things, it's a little complex stuff. It's a complex thing in the sense that it is not a war has nothing to do with the nuclear weapons development or anything like that. That's a trigger that they are trying to use to get the international support. But they didn't generate international support. What they think that they will generate international support is when Iran closes off the Strait of Hormuz, because everybody will be involved in that case, because everybody's oil passes through that area. So they are amassing near Strait of Hormuz to create this quote-unquote inadvertent war, basically to choke Iran. And Iran will hit back, and then everybody in the world will say, well, Iran, hey, my economy is getting affected. It is Iran shouldn't do this. And so they are expecting, the hope here in Washington, among the powers that be, that we'll get an international support in war against Iran, and only if that international support will come. Only if Iran closes off the Strait of Hormuz. But the fact is, this Iran thing is a lot more complex stuff. A lot more complex in the sense that long before, and in fact from the very inception of Israel, if you go and see the British role in there, and this number of British spooks, and the leading one is Gertrude Bell, and you'll see that Saudis were the key supporters of the Zionists. I mean, in fact, in the first international conference that Gertrude Bell organized in support of formation of Israel, was inaugurated by King of Saudi Arabia, and he praised Zionism to high heaven. So the question is that, In the Muslim world today, there is nobody who cares about Palestine. Everybody has, for the sake of money, or for the sake of convenience, or for the sake of acceptance, have taken in the British, and which is now the Anglo-British, Anglo-American alliance of the West against the Palestinians. So they are all. There were a couple of people like Saddam Hussein, we have got rid of them. Then there was Gaddafi, we killed him. So basically, there is nobody else. Assad, in a little convoluted way, do support the Palestinians by helping the Hezbollah and all that.
But then what we actually see, Tanu, is that whenever the so-called Arab street is brought in, because after all, the so-called pro-democracy movements claim to be wishing to hear from the population, what we see is that the opposite of what the Project Democracy types and the Agency for International Democracy and the NGOs are saying, which is that there is support for the Palestinians in these populations, and they do have a certain sense that they've been played, that this is a British operation.
Yes. And so, basically now at this point in time, the only country which has really cares or is concerned about Palestine and takes up the issue is Iran. So Iran has to be eliminated. That's one of the reasons. Now, there are many other things that are being put in that context. It's a Shia country which is trying to get...
Tanu, let me go a little bit broader than just the Iran question now, because I think that the other aspect of this discussion today is that if you look at the potential in the Trans-Pacific Alliance, one of the key partners for that would be India. And yet this war that we're talking about that could bring in Iran, Syria, the ongoing war in Afghanistan, and for all intents and purposes, the war on the Pakistan border, how does that play out in terms of the potential for India to have a decisive break with the British Empire and move together with Russia and China?
Well, I think that the British, over a long period of time, have planted the seed of suspicion within the within a section of the Indian political leadership, and against the regional countries like China, Russia, etc., etc. Although I don't think that there is much suspicion exists about Russia, but Indians are deeply suspicious about China. But there is there are also indications that those kind of suspicions are getting eliminated, and India, China, and China is India's number one trading partner. Also, the border talks that are taking place, and I heard from very close contact, is that the Chinese who came to Delhi for the border talks told in private that we have not as yet reached Mount Everest, but we have already climbed quite a bit and very far up. So basically it is I also got personally, I came to know from people who are involved in these talks, that we are the talks are going very well, and there is every indication that it will be resolved, and there is every indication that no further border conflict or any of this kind of stuff will occur
with India and China.
But the problem that comes in is not so much as that as the conflict or the fear of conflict or things like that. The problem in India, which you can which is definitely a British instilled mindset, is that India is not by itself, but India in collaboration with China and Russia has a responsibility to provide leadership in area and in various areas, including the financial system and all that. There is this, you know, the Chinese often say about the Indians, and I'm being an Indian, I heard this, is that the Indians are not Asians. Indians are Indians belong to Europe. They do not represent Asia. In many ways, this statement is correct, not in every sense, but in many sense it is correct, because in the Indians' mindset is that the leadership of the world in matters which are financial, military, and scientific, and et cetera, will come from West, and we have to just go along with them and stay along with them, and we'll be a partner in them, and we are acceptable, they will accept us, and but the leadership will come from there. So therefore, this the lack of realization that the European Union has collapsed.
That brings up an interesting point, because the two areas where you see the potential for India, in fact, what's necessary for India, the nuclear energy development and also the going into space and more advanced technologies, that's being not only rejected in Western Europe, where you have in Germany in particular the shutdown of the nuclear industry, but also the destruction in the United States of NASA, the tearing down of space. There must be some people in India who have paid attention to this and realize that there is a shift, that the financial system has collapsed in the West.
Yes, I think that they do understand that, but they don't want to accept it. The way it goes is that, yes, they are facing a serious downturn, but you know they have the capability to pull their pull themselves up by the bootstraps, and they will be back again. India's collaboration with China and Russia, now this has to be done at a much higher level in the sense, in a higher plane. It is not just, a trading partnership or this and that and that, or even infrastructure interlinking or things like that. It has to be really thought through by all three, and India, I think, in this is way behind. All three, when I say three means China, India, and Russia, they have to start that they now are in a situation. There doesn't exist the old unipolar world. You know, United States is a weak nation. It's not weak because simply because they have gotten themselves mired in two or three nasty wars from which they cannot get out. But the financial system has collapsed. The leadership is almost nothing. But this and our situation, but the situation in the world in the process has worsened and become more precarious. And at this point in time, in order to provide security and stability to this huge region where more than 60% of the population of the world live, the first thing that you have to do is to sit down together and work out a system whereby how we can take the leadership of this difficult world.
Well, let me come back to that in a moment, because I think that's where we want to go in the second half of the program. I have just one other question in terms of the immediacy of war and strategic dangers, which is where do things stand at this point with Pakistan? We've heard quite a bit over time in the raids that went on, the drone attacks, the U.S. involvement, and also anger at Pakistan, and then the Pakistani reaction against the U.S. Where do things stand at this point, to the best of your knowledge, with Pakistan in this very dangerous situation?
I think that the U.S.-Pakistan, the old relationship, which was always a transactional relationship in which I will give you money and you do the dirty job for us, like getting the Russians out of there now and then getting the Taliban or whatever, getting the Al-Qaeda. It is always on a contract basis, like a mafia operation. That relationship cannot be sustained for over a very long period of time, so it has collapsed now. But in the meantime, Pakistan is a nuclear weapon nation. It is not an easy task to go after Pakistan and wage a war. I fully believe that Washington has many gung-ho crowd out there who believe that, yes, it can be done. But the British have a better system. British have a more clever system, which is that British have created all these Arab countries. They are the master of the Muslim divides and various divisions that exist in the Muslim community. So they have unleashed this jihad in Pakistan. So Pakistan has to be weakened and rotten from inside. And through that process, Pakistan has broken up once, and one part became Bangladesh. It can be broken up more because with the help of the jihadis and all that. And this is a British plan, and it's blooming, it's flourishing. United States, often will shows the stick, but that stick cannot be used.
What would happen then if you had a breakup of Pakistan with a Baluchistan or Waziristan? Wouldn't that bring up again the whole question of Kashmir and relations with India?
Well, it may come up, but I think that's not, nobody is really concerned about that. Nobody worries about that. What the British are planning, in fact, it could be a fake dream, but it is there that. We have to eventually go to Central Asia. We have to set up satrapies in Central Asia. And that's what the way the British and the British-led Obama think, is we have to set up satrapies in Central Asia. But in order to set up satrapies in Central Asia, it is necessary to set up satrapies because we will be then in the southern flank of Russia, who has always had this tendency to become a major power. And then we were on the western border of China, which is a weak link of China, because China is really east. West is weak of China, and we can get in there and we can, threaten China's security. So we have to set up satrapies. But in order to set up satrapies, we must have a clear passage from Arabian Sea all the way to Central Asia. So if you can break up Balochistan, then we have something there. Then if we can work out some kind of arrangement with the Taliban in Afghanistan, Forget Taliban's all medieval, cruel, barbaric things. If we can work out an arrangement with Taliban, we'll have a free supply line going all the way to Central Asia. And the Central Asian countries, most of them are extremely poor. They can be bought. And then Soros and the Afghan opium and all this kind of thing has already weakened those leaderships considerably. So therefore, the British are thinking that we must have a place in the southern flank of Russia and the western flank of China. And it can be done because we know the Muslims. We can play the Muslims. We can do all kinds of stuff, and the Americans are with us. So this is what is, I think, is in the plan.
But this whole British operation then depends on the idea that all of this can be done and Russia will sit back and not do anything. Now, what I'd like to get to in the time we have remaining, which is about 25 minutes...
Can I, Harley, let me make one comment on this whole discussion before we go on. What Tano described in the Iran situation it might sound like it's a hopeless case, that the war is on, that there's no way to stop it, it's going to happen, there's going to be a Strait of Hormuz crisis, and there's going to be a blow-up. And, of course, Lynn and other U.S. military people have said that that would lead almost inevitably to this conflict with Russia and China. So the situation is desperate, but not absolutely hopeless. And I think it's important to note that that can't happen without the U.S. backup. The Europeans and the Saudis and so forth don't have the military capacity to carry out the kind of massive warfare that would be not just on Iran itself, but which would be sparked off by such a war. This depends on this U.S. support, which means it depends on Obama.
The British don't have the power to do that.
Absolutely not. So, I mean, when LaRouche talks about the fact that there's only one issue, which is to get this lunatic Obama out of office, he means that if we don't, we have a U.S. which is in the kind of circumstance Tano described, which is already on course and irreversibly committed to a war which could bring the entire civilization if not an end, then something that we wouldn't want to think about. But if we get Obama out, the process of getting him out of office, getting people focused on the scope of this danger, economically but especially strategically, then you have the potential of the U.S. doing what it in the past has done, which is to intervene in situations like this, sort of like Eisenhower did with the Suez, and just say, like hell, you aren't going to do it. No. And we can stop this. It requires that scope and that immediate action to get this character out of the White House.
Well, and this is what Lynn discussed. Again, let me tell our listeners that on LaRouchePact.com, you can see the State of the Union address given by Lyndon LaRouche on January 18th, where... if anything, he was highly optimistic, partly because he's seen the effect of the mobilization of our forces, which include a lot of our listeners, that people have been mobilizing, getting out leaflets over the Christmas holidays in particular, but continuing, that we've had a very solid, consistent mobilizing process. Now, in a discussion, I think it was yesterday, one of the things Mr. LaRouche brought up is this idea that when you're talking about war avoidance, and let me reiterate, I completely agree with what you said, Mike, that Obama is the key, getting him out. But with war avoidance, and this is also what Tanu was talking about in terms of China and India, you do have to go to a higher realm of statecraft, which is not just, we won't shoot you if you don't shoot us, or we'll trade this for that, but it's actually working on the kind of collaboration which was proposed originally by Mr. LaRouche with the Strategic Defense Initiative, and which now, ironically, seems to be coming from the Russians and to some extent from the Chinese in the form of economic cooperation agreements, which Obama is standing in the way of. So if you can, Mike, and then Tano, just give a sense of where we stand on the potential for this kind of collaboration on these higher level areas of new physical principles, not so much that the U.S. is doing it, but the potential that's there.
On the development side of this, of course, Rachel Douglas is the person who knows this best, but the level of collaboration between Russia and China on the idea that they must collaborate, not just that it's a good idea, but that they must collaborate on the development of this massive, resource-rich, almost unpopulated Far East of Russia, Siberia and the Russian Far East generally, is moving quite rapidly, maybe not rapidly enough, but it's very serious, and especially with the shift in Russia, with Putin reasserting his collaboration with Medvedev and probably to be the next president if Soros and his gang don't succeed in blowing it up with their, you know, their antics in Moscow right now. But that this potential includes not just the rail connection up to the Bering Strait, but massive development of the oil resources, the potential of other energy development processes, and it engages the rest of Asia. The Japanese, almost all the crisis points in Asia are left over from colonialism in the Second World War. The ones that Tanu just described in the South Asia, you have lack of cooperation between Russia and Japan left over, again, mostly over territorial disputes, over some islands that were taken away from, you know, Japan after the war. And also animosity from Korea towards Japan because of the occupation and because of similar problems that have developed since the war. So all of this stuff is left over. And you cannot break these things except by inspiring nations and the peoples of nations to the kind of great developments that are feasible, that are possible, when you break those animosities and when you pose something of a higher order which calls upon the true humanity in each and every person. So I'm not going to try to give you a scope of those developments, but I think, in fact, Tanu can probably talk more about the whole question of the scientific aspect of what we can aspire to, the same way that Lynn talks about fusion and going to Mars as sort of characterization of what's needed to move the minds of the masses of the human race.
Well, and that's the only form in which Lynn says we can change the subject, is we change the subject from an election campaign of a bunch of fools braying about debt ceilings and things of that sort. We change the subject to the issue of human progress. And, of course, this is where, if you look at Asia, as Tanu pointed out, what is it, 60% of the world's population in this region, this is an area which, on the one hand, has certain highly advanced scientific capabilities, but they're not generalized, and you have incredible poverty. So what are you seeing in terms of this collaboration or cooperation in the scientific arena, Tanu?
Well, my only hope is that reality will eventually hit them on the head. I mean, of all Chinese and Russians and Indians and even the Japanese, and they'll realize that they have to get their head together and, you know, pick up the pieces. But, you know, not always the reality, understanding of reality gives you the right motivation to do things. Like, for example, Pakistanis used to believe that U.S. is a true ally. Now the reality they have faced now, have realized the reality is at such a late stage that they are in a deep trouble to even do something good for themselves again. Now, the point is that there is enormous amount of scientific capability that Russia has, and Mr. LaRouche has repeatedly pointed out, and the history shows that. China, India, you know, because India once upon a time was a kind of a pariah state, because of its non-aligned movement and all that, so then its nuclear power development, space research were completely indigenous, and they developed a pretty good cadre of scientists and technicians and engineers and all that.
How much aid was there from Russia during the Soviet Union period and afterwards in the development of the Indian science, especially the nuclear program?
No, nuclear program, there is virtually nothing. Originally, the nuclear program goes back to the Atom for Peace days, and American input was there. American input was significant, and but I think from subsequently it was indigenous, and Russians were. Russians were in the Cold War days were as reluctant to provide India with a reactor than they didn't provide a single reactor. U.S. had two reactors they sent in 1968. Not a single Russian reactor ever came to India. Now they are building one, two. So no, but the impact of the Russian science and technology, because there was always an exchange of scientists that were taking place during the Cold War days. I think it has got a significant impact on that. I think a lot of Indians got a lot of Indian scientists got trained in Russia and all that. But what I'm trying to get at is that Russia has an enormous amount of scientific capability. China has developed very significant the scientific capability and technological capability. India has some. Now, the problem, as I see, and is this, is that Russia is a pessimistic state, has become a pessimistic state. Its population is going down. Now, in no way Russia can ever develop its eastern part until unless they bring people in from Asia, I think particularly China, India, Central Asia, and that kind of area. Until now, let's do that. Now, this has to be done, not like, you get an engineer for 2 years contract. And now, India and China, if you want to get a good senior engineer who is really useful, he will not go for 2 years because there is enough going on in their own countries that they want to stay there. So you have to develop a U.S.-style immigration system, whereby the people, first generation of the people that will come in from India, China, you can call them losers, they may come in, but their children, you have to train their children just the way it was in the United States and make them fit true citizens and who will be contributing to Russia's Siberia development. Without that, I don't see that Russia has a shot.
Well, but I think this is where, in particular, what Mr. LaRouche is talking about now with the Mars program, with fusion,
right,
and centering that around two specific proposals. One is NUWAPA, which then connects with the Bering Strait project on into the area of North Asia that, Mike, you were talking about before. And the other is the development of the Arctic,
right,
where in both of those cases, the Russians have made overtures to the United States. Mm-hmm. Mike, I assume this is where you see this kind of potential to move into a whole new area of collaboration if we didn't have to do Obama in the White House.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in fact, one of the reasons that the far east of Russia is so underpopulated is, although it's not all as difficult to live in as the Arctic, it's nonetheless extremely difficult to live in. And I think what Putin understands and what Lynn has emphasized and what Tanu just said is fascinating. You have to make this place habitable. Which means you can't just go in there and take out the raw materials. It won't work. It won't happen. You have to actually conceive of building entire cities. And again, you get into this question like the Arctic of how do you take an area that's extremely cold, tundra, difficult, not accessible to normal kinds of agriculture, and transform it into a well-powered, well-fed city with people who want to go and live there. And then, as Tana just said, you have to actually have a policy that invites people to come, like America, which was the beacon of hope and the temple of liberty. You have to have that concept in your head that this is what can become of Russia if you break the prejudices, break the kind of animosities between nations and cultures, and think in terms of this kind of global development, preparing the way for the Arctic, preparing the way for the moon, preparing the way for Mars, where we have to collaborate.
The other point that you were making about making it habitable gets to the one of the central themes of Mr. LaRouche, which is energy flux density. You can't do it with windmills and solar power. You have to go in with the most advanced technologies.
You're not going to melt a lot of ice with a solar panel.
Now, and Tanu, how do you see that as a realistic factor? I mean, the Russians did build some scientific centers in the Asian area, Novosibirsk, for example.
Right. Now, there is not an iota of doubt in my mind that Russia has all the scientific and technological capabilities built in. However, it doesn't have the manpower to do the kind of thing that is necessary for the Eurasia landmass development. Now, in order to do the Eurasia landmass development, it needs a lot of manpower, it needs a lot of technology, it needs a lot of science, and this China, between China and India, there's a lot of manpower and a lot of technologies, but science doesn't exist that much. If we include Japan in, then also you'll get another notch higher level of technology. But they have to be put together. If you can't sit on the table, Russia, China, India, and Japan, to work out a problem which is problem of everybody, and say, let's solve it, because the Westerners are not going to solve it, not because Westerners hate us, but simply because Westerners' financial system has collapsed, everything has collapsed, and pessimism is all over West. They're not going to do anything for themselves. What do you expect? You expect they'll do it for us?
But, Tanu, this is exactly where the other point Mr. LaRouche keeps making, reviving the tradition of Franklin Roosevelt.
Right.
Because this was Roosevelt's conception. To some extent, it existed in the Adams for Peace policy. It existed to some extent with John Kennedy. And since the 60s, it's been gone.
Right.
And if you actually could get rid of Obama and restore to the American people a leadership which had that conception, then what you're talking about, bringing these other countries together, it would seem to me that would be possible.
You see, I point out to many people, who are organizers and all that, that I came to this country in late 1970, year 1970, late part of it. I think I came in December. Now, between 1955 to another 70, I came, another 6 or 7 years, 1977, that's around the time Carter came in. What the U.S. had achieved. U.S. had built 85 nuclear power plants. Another 10 or 15 were under construction. U.S. developed the entire space program and sent not one person, but many people to the moon. Entire highway system was built during that time. In 25 years, that's a generation, 5 years, United States, did what nobody else could have done since or could has done ever. But since 1977, 1978, until 2012, now we are in this 34 years, only thing we have done so far is space shuttle. That's all, unless you consider that the removal of dismantling of Glass-Steagall was an achievement. In 1978 to 2012, this is all we did. And we sat on our butt for 34 years. And now we have come to a situation in which you need an optimism of the kind that was instilled through FDR, then Eisenhower, then Kennedy. But again, as I said, I pointed out, particularly because I see that the United States still has, United States has the capability to do things which other countries cannot, because they have not resolved their own disparities and own contradictions within themselves, within the Chinese society, Indian society. You call it the British reason, the British were behind. Yes, they were, but nonetheless, you are now a nation and you have to solve these things, and you are there for about 60 years, you have to solve these problems. United States, still, if you put a right man in the White House, and I tell you, within 20, 25 years, you will see entire new things coming up. Fusion technology will become the source of electricity. You will see entirely new development, because this is the tradition of this country.
And Mike, I think from the diplomatic work that you do in Washington, where you do talk to a lot of people from Asia, this is what people are waiting for from the United States, isn't it?
Absolutely. The thing that the best of the people I meet from Asia who are here are people who have studied the United States, who know what we were, and who are just absolutely dumbfounded as to why we shut ourselves down. I'll mention one brief anecdote. A leading economist from Japan who was here, who had that exact question for me over and over again. I understand the U.S. shut itself down, but why? I can't understand why. And he had a meeting with Lynn, a private meeting, and Lynn went through the whole history of the British retaking, the recapturing of the United States, mm-hmm. with the death of Roosevelt, but especially the killing of the Kennedys, the launching of this environmentalist insanity, this anti-science, anti-human, psychologically self-destructive ideology that has, taken over and destroyed this country. And as we left that meeting, he just said to me, "Ah, okay, now I understand. Now I understand empire versus human republican development." So
this is why the State of the Union address by Lynn was so important. Obama's going to deliver some kind, or I should say his teleprompter will deliver some kind of address this coming week. But you have the opportunity with Lynn where he started by saying there are four things I'm going to discuss. He went through them, and he had no nonsense in the questions that came in and in his answers. And it's precisely this. What people see in Lynn is not just the depth of knowledge about empire versus republic, but that creative spark of optimism, you know, the sense that these things can be done. And, Tanu, I was really struck by what you said about that 25-year period.
Yeah.
Because, you know, growing up in the United States, I was born in 1949, and to me the high point was the Kennedy years, yeah. And everything's been downhill from there. And you actually see that this is when Lynn says we've had a decline in our physical economic production every year since the late 60s. We now see where we are, where we can't produce these things. So if we just have a couple minutes left, I want to come back to this question then, that it's clear from this discussion that the solutions are there. Now, what can we expect? Is there anything coming up, Mike, in terms of a calendar or developments on the Asian side of things, the Chinese or the Koreans or Japan?
Well, not exactly a calendar, but what you have is a move towards these joint discussions on Korea, the restoring of the six-party talks. I'm not convinced the six-party talks are absolutely the best forum for discussing the Korea thing, but at least it brings those nations together. I think if you have Obama in the White House, nothing's going to happen with the six-party talks. But if you have the saner elements, including, you know, even our current State Department under Hillary, or something better if we can get this character out, then there's no question but that idea of bringing about the cooperation, not just to solve the Korea problem, but to open up the potential for the development of all of Asia. This brings in Southeast Asia as well. And in fact, let me just mention, Hillary, one of her successful moves towards reestablishing sanity in Asia was to break the demonization of Myanmar, which is now, you know, transforming itself because the State Department, despite the hatred of the neocons and the British liberal Soros-type Democrats, is now being integrated, as it should have been, into the whole region. And there's some people that want to play that as an anti-China thing. But our Russian friends see that Hillary is trying to bring about, Voronsov, the head of the Russian Academy of Sciences Far East Institute, said explicitly, Hillary is on the phone with the Chinese, with the Russians, with the South Koreans, to say, let's make this North Korean breakthrough the basis upon which we have the kind of Myanmar breakout, only on a much, much bigger scale, which can bring about, you know, the kind of development we've discussed.
And, Tanu, we really have no time to do justice to this, but I know you've been following very closely some of the almost baby steps in fusion. You were talking about moving to produce electricity from fusion. What will that take?
Well, it's easy thing to say that if we put a lot of money in it, it will come out quickly. But I'm not so sure about that. I think that fusion is still very much remained in the laboratory state, in the stage, in the sense that can we have fusion reaction in the reactor, one kind of reactor or the other? And yes, we can, and that has been proven. Now, from there, we have to go into the next stage, which is that we have to have a continuous reaction so that there's a continuous generation of electricity. Then the third stage, of course, is to how to take that electricity and use it for mankind's benefit. Now, these two stages have not been done. Now, just by putting money, I don't think the two stages can be done. We have to start thinking of building an infrastructure for introducing this new technology, which is an entirely different thing, new technology into our development of industries and manufacturing and betterment of environment and all that kind of stuff. Now that
and getting us to Mars,
getting
well,
us to Mars.
Let me just say, because since we're running out of time, the obvious point is that those first two steps would be greatly facilitated if the third step, where we had the collaboration with a mission orientation,
right.
Then you're not just talking about money, you're talking about intention. You're talking about inspiring a population,
right.
The same way the Americans were inspired with the space program under Kennedy.
Right.
And then you're talking about what Lyndon LaRouche always discusses, time itself changes. Instead of a linear assessment of when we'll make the breakthrough, you actually create jumps in mankind's mm-hmm. creative powers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, I think this has been a very interesting discussion for me. I'm very happy that both of you were able to join me. I think I want to reiterate one final time that our listeners should go to the LaRouchePact.com and listen to the full State of the Union address from Lyndon LaRouche. The transcript, if it's not up already, will be up on LaRouchePact.com. Make that your homepage on your computer. And Mike and Tanu, thank you very much for joining us this week. We'll be back next week for another edition of The LaRouche Show.
Thank you, Harley.
Thank you for listening.
Thanks a lot, Harley.
Okay.
Bye.